Hello and welcome everybody to the third Living Room Times podcast. We are coming to you the day after USC finally decided to start playing football and demolish the hippies, also known as the commies, also occasionally known as the Bears.
Of Cal,
yeah. The final score was 186-0 or something like that.
I have to say that I was really happy for Lane Kiffin to hopefully he can get a couple monkeys off his back because the USC fans have been absolutely ridiculous with their expectations of him.
You mean like my Twitter hashtag of Kiffin haters for Kiffin?
Because people expect him to be able to have a national championship team his first year there, and when the team is struggling a little bit, they're all like, "Oh, he's no Pete Carroll." Well, Pete Carroll didn't exactly make the team dynamite his first year there either. So
unfortunately, Lane Kiffin's going to have to deal with scholarship reductions and all kinds of stuff in subsequent years. They're going to make it harder for him to succeed the way Carroll did. But I just found out that USC is tops and others receiving votes in this week's AP poll. So that means that we'll probably be ranked next week just by attrition. We don't play next week, but somebody's going to lose. So we'll be ranked by the time we play Oregon. And Oregon, assuming they don't
fight on Trojans.
Yeah, assuming that Oregon doesn't lose to UCLA next Thursday night, which is always possible because UCLA is the most inconsistent team in the country. But assuming they don't lose to UCLA, Oregon will be the number one team in the country when they come to the Coliseum in 2 weeks on my birthday. So I'd like to go on record now as sending a message to Lane Kiffin that what I would like for my birthday is a win over the number one team in the country. Thank you. Okay. Anything else to say about USC?
No.
All right. So let's move on to our first segment. And this time I want you to go first because I keep going first on this.
Wait.
What? Oh, shoot. Wait a minute. The volume's down.
I don't know what my favorite part is.
Oh.
You have to go first so I can think of something.
Oh, my gosh. All right, fine.
What was your favorite part?
So for my favorite part of the week, this week, I'm going to talk about sort of a big new project that I started this week. And it requires a little bit of background. So this is going to be slightly longer. What was your favorite part than previously? But, as some of you know, last March, February and March, I got sucked in fully and completely into the sort of world of Kyle Wellison and his mid-major obsessives on Twitter and the internet. I had been a follower of his blog back in the day, and I always liked his work. But
so this is a terrible explanation. For those of you who have no idea what Brendan's talking about right now, Kyle Wellison follows the sort of less popular basketball teams in college basketball. So you're talking about teams like
Butler, Northern Iowa, like St. Mary's, those teams that we all remember, or if we follow college basketball, and we remember from the Sweet 16 last year, but also the Central Connecticut States and the University of Buffaloes and the Southland Conference teams.
So teams that aren't getting any major media play. Right. He doesn't follow Duke or anything
right.
like that. Okay, go on.
Right. Basically, the teams that have less revenue, where their athletic departments make under a certain amount of revenue, that's his what he calls the red line, and the teams below that line are the quote-unquote mid-majors. So anyway, Kyle had this thing last year that he did back at the beginning of the season called the Certificates of Emotional Investment. And the idea was that he was encouraging people, if you didn't have a mid-major school that you went to or a team that you already rooted for, rather than jumping on the mid-major bandwagon in March like everybody does, pick a team in November at the beginning of basketball season and say, I'm going to follow this team. I'm going to adopt this mid-major as my team, and I'm going to follow them all year long. And I didn't find out about the Certificate of Emotional Investment generator until it was too late to participate in this. But I thought it was a great idea, and I decided that this season I wanted to do that for the University of Denver, which is the local mid-major team that gets very little attention because Denver isn't a college sports town anyway. And to the extent that I have to interrupt this, I have to do a play-by-play on what just happened, and then I'll go back to my story. So our Sasha, one of our cats, was just climbing up on the windowsill and being irritating and making noise and playing with the shades. So Becky went over with a spray bottle and sprayed it at her. It reminds me of another cat story, but I'll tell that when I'm done. So anyway, I decided that I wanted to do this. I wanted to follow the University of Denver. And then it occurred to me, well, you know, I have a blog. I have a journalism degree. I could actually do so. I'm more than just being a fan. I could like make it this little blog project. So I decided,
because he's not busy enough.
Right, of course not. Not at all. So I decided to make that sort of my mission to blog about the University of Denver this year. So I got in touch with the sports information director, Michael Kennedy, or the assistant SID for basketball. Turns out, you know, I didn't know how he would react to some random guy being like, hey, I want to blog about your team. Can you give me press credentials? But it turns out he's a big Kyle Wellaston fan himself. And he immediately sort of cottoned on to what I was doing, thought it was a great idea, and was happy to give me a media pass. I mean, it's the University of Denver. They don't have tons of media beating down their door anyway. But nevertheless, it was very nice of him to give me access. So now I've got a media pass. I went to the opening practice on Friday.
Which I guess would be your favorite part.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I interviewed the coach Joe Scott, who's kind of a big deal. He used to be the coach at Air Force. He was, sort of a rising star in coaching. And sat down with him and talked to him about the season and just got to watch the practice and everything. And it was fun. And it's something that's going to, it's sort of the kicking off point for something that I'm hoping to have a lot of fun with over the next few months. The basketball season doesn't really get into full swing for another month or so, but anyway, so that was kind of my favorite, part of the week, I guess, was just sort of starting off my DU blog, which, by the way, I'm still trying to name. The Denver is they're known as DU or the University of Denver, and the Pioneers. The Pioneer Post is the only thing that came to mind. I've got a couple other suggestions that people have made, but nothing that I'm in love with yet. So if anybody listening to this has any suggestions for a name for a blog about the University of Denver Pioneers, suggest it.
It's just a terrible name for a basketball team. I mean, the Pioneers, really, like, how do you even cheer? You're like, ride the wagon, go Bull, that's towing. I mean, I did Bull tow the wagon, donkey, whatever. My favorite part of the week is actually something that's a recurring thing that comes with me to our Stroller Strides class on Mondays.
Who comes with me to your Stroller Strides class?
Loyette. Thank you. So Loyette comes with me to, and of course Loyacita, to Stroller Strides, which is basically a stroller circuit workout that I do because I'm too cheap to join a gym, and I enjoy being able to drag the kids with me when I work out, and they like to walk outside in the stroller, so it works for everybody. But one of our instructors, the amazing Karen Alenowitz, has started a Stroller Strides class for the kids, like a wee Stroller Strides class. And so I get to watch Loyette as she runs around and does the same exercises that we do during class with a bunch of other 2 to 4 year olds. And if you have never seen little kids doing aerobics, it is probably the most adorable thing you ever see. Because it's really difficult for a 2 year old or a 3 year old to do a jumping jack or to do a push-up or to, you know, they play with parachutes and do all sorts of cute things. And Loyette is just really enjoying herself. And in doing that, it's fun to watch her grow and to know that we're starting and sowing the seeds of really good, positive habits in terms of, you know, exercising and being active and enjoying it. So so that's probably my favorite part of the week. And it's something I get to do every week, so I love it.
We also did have this week our something that I alluded to last week. Yesterday, we had our family pictures that I think we haven't seen the pictures yet, but I think they came out well. At least some of them did.
And can I tell you that going to family pictures is something that I dread. Like, my entire body becomes tense. I get all this tension in my shoulders, my back, because I know that the kids are going to scream and cry. And I know that the photographer is going to look at us like, can't you make your kid happy? No, I can't make my, I just can't snap my fingers and make them smiley and adorable. But we had a pretty good photographer this time around. She's very patient. I think we probably got some really cute pictures.
One of the things, if there are any photographers listening to this podcast among our 30 listeners or whatever, one thing that frustrates me sometimes, and our photographer yesterday was pretty good about this, but you sometimes get photographers who will, you know, they have an idea for a picture they want to take. And you try to pose the kid, and the kid freaks out. And then they want you to, like, try again. And they're like, obsessed with the pose that they have in their head. And it's like, you know what? Particularly with a kid like Loyacita, like, if you try, and then she screams, and then you try again, she'll freak out, and she'll be freaking out for 10 or 15 minutes. So it's like, you ruin the entire photo shoot trying to get one picture, and it's like, sometimes you just have to say, no, let's try something else. The one photo is not that important. So that would be my advice to any toddler photographers or baby photographers listening to this right now. Are you done?
Mm-hmm.
Before we go on to the next thing, I wanted to tell a story that I actually haven't told you yet. It's not much of a story, but last night I was down watching college football, sitting on the couch, and all of a sudden I hear this like thud and this sort of strange noise, and I look over. Toby had fallen asleep on top of the couch, and like in her sleep rolled off. So I look over there, and there's this like confused cat like lying on her back on the couch, like. It was hilarious, but I looked at her and she sort of looked like confused, a little bit embarrassed, and just sort of irritated. You know, she wasn't like mewling, screaming or anything. She was just like, "What the hell just happened? And why am this is very undignified." You know, Toby's a very dignified cat, and she was just like, the look on her face was just like, "Ah, this is so undignified." Anyway, you had a topic that you wanted to talk about this week, so I'll let you take it away.
I do have a topic, and it sort of tangentially relates to our Dave Ramsey discussion of last week, in that one of the issues facing Colorado, and obviously facing our political candidates this time around, is the reality that Colorado is not going to get stimulus money next year because there is no more stimulus money left. And so we have...
Because the stimulus is an evil socialist program designed by Nazis.
What? basically, because you know, the stimulus money has been filling gaps in state budgets, but next year we have a $1.1 billion gap to close, which means that everything is going to be cut. Every department is going to face cuts. And, you know, where you cut your budget... Brennan, this is really distracting. You can't be typing and searching for things on the computer. Well, I am working.
Here's the plan. We get the warhead and we hold the world ransom for $1 million.
Well, don't you think we should maybe ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days. Virtucon alone makes over $9 billion a year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. Okay, then. We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
Okay, sorry. Come on.
Anyway, some people would say that he has ADD. I don't know what they're talking about. You know, one of the things that I've been looking at in my political candidates is how reasonable their platforms are in dealing with answering questions about how they intend to handle the budget crisis. And so I don't really consider Dan Mays a legitimate candidate for governor. I don't think he can win, so I don't really care about what he has to say. But I was looking at Tancredo's platform and at Hickenlooper's platform. Now, Tancredo is actually running as an independent, but he's pretty much a Republican. And Hickenlooper is the Democratic candidate who most people think will win the election. So,
when we're done with the budget part of this, I'm going to talk a little bit about the politics, but I'll save that.
So, anyways, you know, I started looking at each candidate's website. And Tancredo has a platform on his website that's, I think, basically like 18 to 20 things, promises that he'll make to the voters of Colorado. And absolutely none of them have anything to do with how he intends to cut money from the budget, aside from saying that he won't fund any organizations that provide abortions, which personally I'm just not all that invested in abortion. I don't really want a candidate who has a strong opinion either way because I just think it's a terrible thing. I don't really want my politician to feel passionately about it, I guess.
Well, and it's not the most important issue facing the country or the state.
Exactly.
To some people, it's obviously this is a pressing moral issue, but at the end of the day, is it really the primary function of government to be sitting around arguing about abortion when we have like massive, massive deficits
and $1 billion to deal with cutting out of the budget. And Tancredo's positions, I think, are actually, I found them incredibly frustrating as a voter. There are some things I agree with. Like, for example, he thinks that child molesters should have mandatory prison terms on their first offense. Okay, I totally agree with that. But that was pretty much his only commentary on crime. And anybody who really knows Colorado politics knows that we have pretty crowded prisons, and we need to be talking about how to keep people out of prison, how to reduce prison costs. And Tancredo's only commentary on his positions was a proposal, which I happen to agree with, but a proposal that would actually increase the cost of prison because you'd be putting more people in prison without any acknowledgement of that fact or any explanation of how to pay for it. He also said that he wanted to reduce fees and taxes, but we already have, as I said, a $1 billion budget deficit in Colorado. By statute, the budget in Colorado has to be balanced, so there's no borrowing to fill in gaps. So it's all coming out of cuts or raising taxes, which nobody is really advocating at this point. So I don't think it's the time to cut taxes necessarily because of that massive gap in revenue. And I was frankly unimpressed by Tancredo's platform position that he wants to reduce fees without any explanation of how he intends to make up the revenue. Because it's a great thing. One thing that Colorado voters are pretty angry about is that the legislature, basically voters in Colorado passed a taxpayer's bill of rights. It's called the Tabor amendment, I think, or the Tabor proposal, something like that. Tabor, T-A-B-O-R.
Yeah. Everyone just calls it Tabor.
Tabor, yeah. And it basically prevents the state government from raising taxes too much or lowering taxes, I think, too much in a given year. So they're limited by percentages. And to kind of get around that, the Democrats and the legislature raised fees on things like your car. So to get your license plates, it's a pretty hefty fee. I think it was like $400 for us. So it's definitely not negligible. But they kind of have to find creative ways to impose these levies because those fees pay for the roads. Now, Tancredo on his website said, okay, we'll do away with these fees, which makes me wonder how exactly we're going to pay to keep our roads in shape. So I was actually, you know, reading through Tancredo's platform, I was really disappointed because I want to like him. I think that it's very important to have good ideas from both parties coming forward. But I couldn't take him seriously. He also had positions on his website like he was going to oppose international treaties that might limit guns. And I'm like, great, as the governor of Colorado, you're going to lobby the Congress not to pass treaties. That's a great use of your time. You know, I understand that these are hot button talking points for some Republicans who feel very strongly about the Second Amendment. And you know what? Colorado's big in hunting and fishing. I personally don't care if somebody has their rifle and they go out and they shoot a deer, and good for them. Awesome. I think they should have the right to do that. I also don't think that like we should have assault weapons or automatic rifles on like machine guns on the streets of Denver. So I'm moderate on this issue.
Well, those are illegal anyway, but
yeah, well, you know, but I think that imposing restrictions on this thing, or you know, requiring certain types of documentation and waiting periods at gun shows, that kind of thing, I don't have a big problem with that. But anyways, Tancredo's platform was disappointing. Now, and I went to Hickenlooper's website, and you know, I'm not going to pull one of these like Democratic liberal, oh, and Hickenlooper's positions were perfect. But I thought that Hickenlooper had very well thought out position papers instead of just one sentence zingers like Tancredo had. You know, Hickenlooper actually had his position and how he intended to implement that position. And I thought that it was a much more mature and actually implementable platform.
Like the platform of someone who's intending to become governor.
Governor, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It was, this is a serious candidate who actually has plans that he could follow through on. For example, Hickenlooper's position on crime was that one of the problems that's facing Denver is that our public schools have something like a 47% dropout rate in high school. It's very, very high, and it's much higher among Hispanic youth than among white youth. And in some school districts, it's 70% of the kids will not graduate. When Hickenlooper was mayor of Denver, he visited all of the Denver public schools and has made a real commitment to educating kids. Now, how does this relate to prisons? People who graduate from high school are much less likely to commit crimes, and also the recidivism rates for people who have a high school education are lower. So this is sort of a long-term idea, you know, to try to boost the schools to keep people out of prisons. You know, it's obviously not going to help for this budgetary term. And a lot of Hickenlooper's ideas didn't necessarily specifically address how he would cut money out of the budget. But at least he has ideas that eventually will lead to reduced spending, unlike Tancredo's ideas of decreasing taxes and increasing spending without any acknowledgement of that kind of quandary that he's putting the legislature in. I felt that Hickenlooper's positions on things like energy, on how he intended to create jobs and keep, you know, business taxes low, I thought that he had a lot of good ideas on that, born of his experience as a successful business owner in Denver. I personally can vote for Hickenlooper based on his platforms. I feel comfortable electing somebody who has that kind of specificity, or at least that kind of outline in his plan. I think that he actually can do this. Tancredo, I don't think so. I think that he's a bit of an extremist, to be honest. I think that he needs to be a little bit more serious as a candidate, and also more moderate, frankly. I don't see Hickenlooper as like a hardcore leftist, and I do see Tancredo as pretty hardcore right.
Yeah, I mean, Hickenlooper in general is pretty well respected from what I gather and understand, even from just talking to some of my colleagues at work who are Republicans and conservatives. The Hickenlooper, he's not loved, he's not adored by conservatives, but he's also not loathed by them. He's someone who they generally respect. That, you know, they say that he's not like a totally anti-business Democrat. You know, he's someone who's been in business. He's even if they don't agree with all of his platforms, he's someone who's at least reasonable and you can negotiate with and you can talk to, and that he's a fairly moderate guy. I think that the broader issue, though, in terms of lack of specificity and all that, is something that has been plaguing the Republican Party both nationally and in Colorado.
It's a lack of message. Like they.
Well, no, they have a message. Their message is
Obama sucks. Well, and no, you can't run for governor on Obama sucks.
Well, no, but their message is more than Obama sucks. Their message is we are suddenly the party of fiscal responsibility, and we will cut spending and we will oppose cut taxes or at least oppose raising taxes. And how will we raise revenue? By cutting spending. Well, what spending? Well, we'll cut it across the board. Well, what are you going to cut? Everything. But saying everything is like saying nothing. It's a meaningless statement because you can't cut everything. And of course, they don't actually, as soon as you start drilling down, well, are you going to cut this program? No. Are you going to cut this program? No. And it's a meaningless statement, because what you're doing is, and it makes a lot of political sense, but what you're doing is you are not taking the heat for the individual things that people actually like, because if you ask the average person, you know, do you want your government to be smaller? Yes. Everyone, you know, 90% of the public will say that, including hardcore Democrats. Everybody wants the government to be smaller. But then when you ask about specific things, people like that the government does this. They like their libraries. They like their national parks. They like their...
It's the value judgment. Like, liberals would cut the military. Conservatives would cut social programs.
Right. But even when you say social programs, you know, when the average, like, suburban soccer mom hears social programs, they think, like, you know, money going to poor people, to lazy poor people. But when you actually address what programs you mean and what types of benefits, like, people always support the concept of government cuts, but they often oppose the specifics, and the Republicans are taking advantage of that. And Tancredo is an example of someone who is saying, you know, I will cut spending, but they won't tell you how. And there's actually specifically this happened in Colorado just a week or so ago, I think I heard on NPR that some Democratic leader in the legislature was basically challenging the Republicans in the legislature to come out with a specific list of cuts for next year's budget. And the Republicans aren't doing it. They haven't done it. They will not give them a list of the cuts that they want. Because as soon as you start cutting specific things, it becomes unpopular. Now, obviously, if Tancredo is elected, he's going to have to be more specific. Yeah. And the same thing is true of the Republicans nationally, which is one of the reasons why I think it's not altogether a bad thing if the Republicans gain back at least one House of Congress, because it's going to force them to actually govern or actually help govern. But as for, I think part of what you wanted to get into a little bit more broadly, segueing in from all this Tancredo stuff, was the concept of, prioritization, prioritization in your budget choices. And you had talked a little bit about the example of the Brits, and I'll let you go into the part of the aspect that you wanted to talk about, but I had a thought about it, which is that, in Britain, they are very now seriously and drastically cutting tons of things, including very, very painful things, and because they are probably a little bit further along than us nationally, though not a ton. Because we're the world's reserve currency, we have more leeway. But they're a little bit further along the road towards, oh my God, we have to cut the budget or we're all going to die. we're going to be there in a few years. The government is very, very serious about this. And
they're not all going to die. I don't like that kind of hyperbole.
No, but I mean,
you need to be specific in what you're saying.
Okay, we have to cut our budget, or our credit rating is going to be downgraded so severely, we'll have runaway inflation, and the country will go into a tailspin from which it may not easily be able to recover.
Better.
And all sorts of other things that I don't fully understand. I mean, I'm not an expert on this stuff. You look at Greece and what's happening in Greece. Basically, the shorthand is, we do this or we become Greece. I mean, that's another way of putting it. Now you've made me lose my train of thought. But the thing that I find interesting about that is that the Brits are currently being governed by a coalition government. Because of the fact that no party got a majority in the last election, the Conservatives had to form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Now, from what I understand about British politics, the Liberal Democrats are sort of the more centrist of the two Liberal parties, even though they might sound like the Greens or something, but they're actually not. They're more, the Labour is Tony Blair notwithstanding, Labour is generally the more liberal, bordering pre-Blair on socialist party, and the Liberal Democrats are the more
absolutely
moderate.
When I interned in Parliament, I had a Labour MP as my boss, and he hosted a Fabian Society tea. So for those of you who want to know about socialism, go ahead and look up the Fabian Society, and you can see what kind of events I was hosting in my youth.
Yeah. Nevertheless, however, that coalition is a coalition of the left and the right, the center left and the center right, or whatever. And what I find interesting about it is that, they are now getting really serious about cutting the deficit, and largely they're being forced into it by circumstances. But I wonder if it helps that they have a sort of a coalition government, so that each side of that coalition has a little bit of political cover. To be like, we're not just doing this on our own. Obviously,
and both sides are responsible.
Right.
Like, both sides own the outcome.
And this is why there's some part of me that hoping against hope wonders if perhaps we will be better off with a divided government over the next 2 years. With the Republicans, I think it's pretty likely they're going to at least control the House. I think the Senate might end up being 50-50, in which case, welcome back, Senator Biden. But I think that perhaps that might move us as a country towards a more responsible way of governing if we have a divided government, because then you have to start making choices in a more serious way. Now, you wanted to you can respond to that, obviously, but you also wanted to talk about the Brits and education and stuff, so I'll shut up and let you.
Yeah, I'm just not sure how that relates back to the Hickenlooper Tancredo thing, but that's okay. I don't have to understand.
I haven't read Hickenlooper and Tancredo's platforms. I was trying to read them on my iPhone in the car this morning. I didn't have time, but in general, I tend to agree with you based on what I have seen about the race that Hickenlooper has a more realistic platform, because he's a more realistic candidate in the sense that, he hasn't really been doing too much campaigning so much as just getting ready to govern. Now, Tancredo's been edging up in the polls. The latest Rasmussen poll, which is a little suspect, Rasmussen tends to lean to the right, but their polls had Hickenlooper within 4 and May's still getting 12% of the vote.
They had Tancredo within 4.
I'm sorry. Tancredo within 4 and May's with 12% of the vote. So the thinking is, well, if May's falls down to like 6%, maybe we have a tie race. I think Hickenlooper will win. I think it'll win by 5 or 6 points. anything's possible.
And,
but
and I would like to say that I am officially endorsing Hickenlooper after reading the platforms.
Yeah.
I encourage you all to read the platforms for yourself.
But I think that in general you're right that Hickenlooper, you know, is certainly the more moderate, the more sane candidate. I mean, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating about this race, and I've on Twitter referred to it as repeatedly with the hashtag Colorado GOP cluster bleep 2010, is that you know, it's been a fascinating race politically, and back in the first stages of the Republicans' meltdown, when Tancredo jumped into the race after both Mays and McGinnis, the two primary challengers, were clearly falling apart, Tancredo said, "I'm going to jump in the race, and I'm going to insist that you guys either drop out or else I'm running." And he had a debate on talk radio, which I'll try to find the clip of and play at the end of the podcast. But he had a debate on talk radio with the chairman of the state Republican Party, and in that discussion back and forth, they were like yelling at each other for 20 minutes or something. And at some point, the chairman of the party said to Tancredo, "Well, what's your platform going to be? Impeach Obama and bomb Mecca?" Which is a comment that Tancredo made one time, that if we're attacked with, we should have as American policy that if we're attacked with WMDs, we'll respond with a bombing Mecca. You know, the fact that now Tancredo is effectively the Republican candidate, even though he's not officially, he's effectively the Republican candidate for governor after the chairman of the party said that to him, is kind of hilarious to me. It's a great race for the political junkie to watch.
It's kind of circling very circuitously around to.
I never circle circuitously.
Is that if the Republicans get less than 10% of the vote, they'll lose their major party status in Colorado.
Yes, which would mean that, for example, in the 2012 election, when it comes to ballot order, normally the Democrats and Republicans are the top two in the ballot. They, I believe, go randomly on who happens to be the top on any given ballot. But instead,
it's alphabetical, isn't it?
No, it's not alphabetical. It's the top two in any given ballot. It's literally random, if I understand it correctly. And then those are for the major parties. And for the minor parties, they also randomly switch. So say in 2012, you'd have the candidate, the Democratic candidate and the American Constitution Party candidate, which is Tancredo's party, would be the top two, flipping in order depending on which ballot it is. And then the Republicans would be competing for ballot space with the Socialists, the Greens, you know.
Which is just hilarious.
Yeah. And the Libertarians. So you potentially, on some ballots, you would have, you know, Obama, and then whoever the American Constitution Party nominates would be switched. And then, like, the Republican candidate, you know, Romney or, God forbid, Palin or whoever it is, could be, like, fifth or sixth on the ballot. It also affects fundraising. It's a big deal. It's going to hurt the party. And there'll be a push, I'm sure, in the legislature by the Republicans to change the law. But if Hickenlooper wins, what motivation does he have to sign that law? Oh yeah, let's bail out the Republicans. No, they get to suffer for the mistake of picking Mays for the next 4 years.
And that's why I love the Tea Party. Okay, so to circle back to what Brendan was saying about the Brits and priorities and budget cutting, the Brits are having a budget crisis of their own, and they have announced that they are going to cut their university budgets by 80%. 80.
Well, I'm cutting the portion of the budgets that funds teacher salaries. The research budget isn't being cut by 80%. No. But
anyway. Yeah. So could you imagine being an administrator at a university and being able to tell your teachers, I have to reduce my staff by 80%, or we have to reduce staff salaries all around? I was saying to Brendan, I can't imagine someone coming into our house and saying, reduce your budget by 80%. It's unfathomable. And that made me realize that's what's happening in Colorado. You know, the governor and the state legislature is going to departments everywhere, to the garbage men, to the teachers, to the police, to the prisons, and saying, you need to cut 10, 15, 20% out of your budget. Happy trails.
And Tancredo potentially make it 25 or 30% with all the cuts that he wants to make, the fees and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't
fathom making up those numbers, needless to say.
Yeah,
but that's a general gist.
Yeah, I mean, I can't fathom it, especially because these departments have already been making cuts. We're getting to the point where, you know, are we going to have our libraries open twice a week? You know, it's a recession, and in some ways, I think that the way that Colorado governs is kind of responsible. But at the same time, I hate the idea that my kids are going to know, based on the availability of resources in their school, that we're in a budget crisis because they don't have specials like music or, you know, art. It's tough. It's really tough. And what's even more devastating about the kind of cuts to schools is that the schools in richer school districts have parents who can fundraise and support the schools so that the kids feel less of those cuts. But the kids in the poor areas, whose parents are A, probably out of work, and B, have less money to give anyway, they're the ones who suffer the most. And I think that that is a great injustice of the system. I'm not sure how to change it, but it sucks. It just really sucks.
But and these problems speak to a broader point, which is something that I actually heard, again, on NPR, which is where I feel like I hear everything. But this is something that's more of a conservative thing that I heard on NPR. Talking about this issue of the broadly speaking of the fact that, you know, governments are having to make all these massive cuts, and talked about the governor of New York, David Paterson, who's a pretty, aside from being scandal plagued, which is what he's kind of known for, that and being blind, but he's also he's a very liberal guy. He's a very sort of, you know, mainline, run of the mill New York liberal, East Coast liberal, elitist, non real American, and he. But he's been talking lately, going to different groups, speaking at different, liberal interest groups, and talking about the notion that, you know, we need to rethink and redefine our concept of what government can afford to do. That it's much more fundamental than, oh, you know, let's make a cut here and a cut there, but that really government has bit off more than it can chew, and that we can't keep doing everything we've been doing. And that's something to hear coming from someone like David Paterson is kind of shocking. You'd expect to hear that from like Tom Tancredo, for example. But it's a very sort of realistic assessment, a pessimistic but I think realistic assessment of where we are. And David Brooks in the New York Times had a column last week about how the great failure of the Democratic Party, or if to put it in Twitter parlance, the epic fail, is that the Democratic Party has in catering to interest groups like, oh, I hate to say this out loud because of my parents, but, you know, public employee unions, for example, has sort of lost sight of what liberalism is supposed to promote, which is not only big government, but government that is effective and gives people things in their lives that they value, because if you don't give them that kind of government, you're inevitably going to enable conservatives who want to cut government. Because the problem is that government is so loaded up now with these obligations that it either can't meet or must cut everything else in order to meet, like these massive unfunded public pensions, that people are – there's no surprise that people are losing faith in government, because the government is no longer flexible enough to give – to afford to do what it used to be able to do. The example that Brooks cited was this some sort of big highway project that's been shelved, I forget where, in some East Coast state, I think. Because there aren't the funds for it. And he was saying, you know, on the one hand, this is a fiscally responsible decision. I think maybe it was New Jersey with Governor Christie, who all of my conservative friends on Twitter have a huge heart on for. But that, you know, he's got this program. And Brooks was saying, you know, it makes sense to cut this highway project or whatever it is, because we don't have the money for it. But on the other hand, you know, whatever happened to like the 1950s when government was much smaller and yet we could afford to build the interstate highway system? Like, why can't government do stuff anymore? Why can't it do things that cost a lot of money anymore? And of course, part of the answer is we're in a huge recession, but part of the answer is more structural than that. It's that government's money is being spent on stuff that isn't necessarily as productive or it isn't building our infrastructure or even supporting our current infrastructure, but instead is either making transfer payments or you know, funding old people, doing stuff that it's been obligated to do, and there's no long-term thinking. So as a result, you know, this debate over big versus small government sort of misses the point. We don't really have room for big government anymore, because we're spending all this money that we can't stop spending on, you know, and of course conservatives would argue that Obamacare is just another example of that. And I think the jury is still out on that, but bottom line is we can't keep operating the way we've been operating. And I don't see either party really offering a good solution to that, which is why I have my grand unification theory of panic. But,
okay. Yeah. Did you have more you wanted to say on that?
And whatever the hell we've just been talking about for the last 25 minutes, our meandering topic of Tom Tancredo and the British Empire.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That should be our tag for this week. So I had another topic that I wanted to bring up.
I think maybe we should save the other topic for next week.
No, I want to talk about it now.
But we're already 40
Brendan,
minutes.
No, Brendan, I'm going to be short. Don't throw things at me. So, in keeping with Brendan's request, I'll keep this short. It's more of an observation than an actual topic, but one of the things that you notice when, especially when you have little girls, I think, and probably if you have little boys too, but I can't speak to that, is that there are a lot of products that are specifically marketed at children, and a lot of sort of corporate images that companies use to market their products to your kids. I saw the greatest example of this on Friday while I was at work, and I was sort of perusing the aisles because nobody was coming over to my table, and there was a package of edamame, which is soybeans for those of you who have been living in a box for the past 10 years, and on this package of edamame, there was a great big picture of Dora the Explorer. Now, the Dora edamame was $2 more expensive than the other edamame, and the other edamame only cost like $1.79 or something. So, I mean, it was more than double the price to have the picture of Dora on the front. And I kept thinking to myself, like, God, what does Dora have to do with edamame? Like, she's a little, like, Mexican girl on adventures. Like, the soybean fields of Mexico are overflowing, I guess. I don't know. But I realized they put cartoon characters on these vegetables to sell them to your kids. They hope that your kids see them as you're walking by and say, Mommy, Mommy, buy that. Now, they've been doing with this with cereal forever.
I could see that being so effective, too, because I could see you walking by with Loyacita and her spotting it and being like, Dora! Dora! Just insanely until you pick it up.
Exactly. And there's actually been some talk of putting, like, Dora stickers on, like, bananas and apples at the supermarket for this exact reason, to get kids to ask mom and dad to buy it, which is very sinister in my mind. You know, has these hand-me-down jammies. Thank you, friends. I always need hand-me-downs. They have, you know, Disney princesses on them. She loves them. They're adorable. But they also teach her a message. They're teaching her about this certain Disney product. So when we go to Walmart and we walk around and she sees Ariel or Aurora or Cinderella, she'll say, Mommy, Mommy, look! And she'll drag me over so we can look. Can we buy that, Mommy? It is so effective, and it scares me just a little bit. I don't think that there's a very realistic way to protect your children from all advertising. I'm not even sure that it's all that harmful to them to be, you know, advertised to, but I do think it's something you have to be aware of, that, you know, your kids have no filters when it comes to this stuff. They see, they want, and they don't understand why they can't have it. And there's some responsibility as a parent to, I don't know, to sort of make them aware of how advertisers are affecting them, not when they're three, but I mean, you know, at some point, I think that everybody needs to sit down and think about the way that products are marketed to us and what it means. I mean, from the coffee that you drink in the morning, and, you know, you're supposed to get your cup of Folgers and inhale over it, and you're like, oh, there's my coffee, now the day is tolerable. You walk into Starbucks, and it says, you know, start a tradition. Here's comfort. What? It's a cup of coffee, you know? But this is people, you're being bombarded by messages and your kids are not immune. So I just wanted to throw that out there as food for thought.
I think the commodification of Walmart is a great travesty in today's society.
What?
No, I just think it's funny that you're like, you walk into Walmart and your kids are being bombarded with advertisement. Like, how dare Walmart be capitalist?
No, that's not what I mean. I mean, it's just that it's just an example of how effective it is. You go into any place of commerce and there's these brands and images that you immediately recognize because of this advertising. And I think that your kids are just much more susceptible to it than you are.
I say we treat this as a teaser topic and see what, if any of our listeners have any thoughts or on this or articles that you've read about it or anything, because I think there's probably a lot more to say about it than we're saying right now. But,
and we can always pick it up at it later.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have any real mature thoughts on it right now, so I don't want to ramble because I never ramble. So I think up next is our 3-minute challenge.
Yep.
Yeah.
Our spousal who cares challenge.
Right. I forgot last week to explain what this is. I figured we might have new listeners we should explain. So the idea of this 3-minute spousal challenge is that one of us comes up with a topic that we figure the other one won't care about at all, and we have to try to maintain conversation about it for 3 minutes. I failed at this last week, but we'll see how Becky does. So I'm going to start my clock No. So my topic for this week is the BCS, which you were anticipating the first week. So the big debate in college football this year is about Boise State and to a lesser extent, TCU. Boise State is undefeated. They look likely to finish undefeated because they've already won their two big games of the year against Oregon State and Virginia Tech. And as of this week, they are now ranked number two in the country. The BCS rankings aren't out yet, but at least in the polls, they're number two behind Oregon. And this is going to cause everyone to freak out and panic because number two means that if that were to hold, they would go to the national championship game. There's a couple of other undefeated teams left, and if those teams win out, they'll probably pass them, but it's very likely that some more undefeateds are going to lose, and Boise could very well end up in the championship game. And then you're going to have this huge, massive discussion of whether they deserve it, and then if they, you know, do they have a chance, and blah, 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 blah. And of course, Boise has won a bunch of big games over the years, but nevertheless, a lot of people don't believe in them. So I wonder what your thoughts are on Boise State potentially playing for the national championship in college football.
You know, I think that these spousal challenges are actually easier for me than they are for you because you have such a long run-up to your actual question that by the time I have to talk, it's only like 2 minutes that I've got left. I actually think it would be really interesting to have Boise be a national champion and contender. And I would like to see that happen, mainly because I hate the BCS. I think it's the dumbest system ever, and I think that that would be a great step forward towards pushing college football to a playoff. Because I think that you'd have teams like, say, Texas has one loss, or Alabama has one loss.
Texas has two, but Nebraska would be.
Nebraska. Yeah. I think Alabama lost, didn't they?
Yeah. Alabama,
so
yeah.
So you have a one-loss Alabama right. team. I'm not sure Boise could beat a one-loss Alabama team. I don't know. I mean, I'm no college football expert, but my impression is that Alabama's pretty good this year.
Right.
And shouldn't they have an opportunity to play for the championship? I remember when USC was one loss with Carson Palmer the year they won
Orange Bowl, two losses that year. But
I mean, yeah. By the end of the year, I thought they were by far the best team in college football. Right. And I thought they deserved to have a shot. And I don't think that team should be, you know, completely erased from contention because they lose early in the season. So I do think that a Boise shot at the championship would be good. And honestly, if Boise goes undefeated and they don't get an opportunity to play in the championship game, I think that'd be a tragedy.
Well, especially considering that they went undefeated last year too, so they would be on like a 25-game winning streak or something.
Exactly. So I mean, how much better can they possibly do? At some point, you have to give these little schools an opportunity, and I think that Boise deserves that. It appeals to my underdog sensibility. So, you know, I've been trained. Hollywood has told me that this is how it has to be. I do think that Boise should get a shot. Yay.
It's actually interesting because one thing you said that it might help lead to a playoff. Some people think the exact opposite, that if you get a Boise or a TCU or a Utah into the title game, that would take the wind out of the sails of the people, the arguments of the people who want a playoff, because all along they've been saying, this system isn't fair, it doesn't give us a shot. And then people would be able to point at that and say, oh yeah, see, look, you have a shot. And it's not really a fair argument because most years you don't have a shot.
But I still think you'd have plenty of SEC fans with their one-loss teams screaming for a chance.
Personally, I think that a one-loss Alabama, if they win out, win the SEC championship, I think they'll jump Boise and go over undefeated Boise. I think the SEC is a unique case because there's just so much hype and everyone thinks they're so awesome that I think a one-loss team from that league will probably jump Boise. A one-loss Nebraska or a one-loss Oregon is a different story. And that's Oregon hasn't lost yet, but if they were to lose, let's say the USC in 2 weeks, for example, that would be an interesting case. Anyway, so there you go. Good job. Things we're looking forward to for next week.
I will go first.
All right.
I'm actually really looking forward to physical Loyacita's physical therapy. For those of you who don't know, our youngest is not walking, which we're not terribly concerned about, but our pediatrician recommended that we start her in a course of physical therapy through a program called Denver Options, which provides actually free physical therapy for kids under the age of 3. It's basically if your kids are missing any sort of milestone, the early intervention statistics are very powerful, that it's more economically advantageous for the government to pay for for the intervention than to leave the kids without it. It helps so much to get in there early. So because she was behind on her 1 year motor milestones, we got recommended for this program, and so we took her in and had her evaluated, and so she qualified. And so she started walking this week, holding onto our hands. So she's 15 months old. So this is not exactly a shocking development, and I should have been doing it for like 6 months, but, whatever. I have come to terms with the idea that I birth late walkers. But it's exciting, and she seems so proud of herself when she walks around. So I'm really happy to be able to show, our physical therapist, Sarah, that we're making such great progress with her, and that the therapy really has been very effective, and she likes it a lot.
I always forget to think about this in advance, and then I can never think of what am I looking forward to about the next week. it'll be easy next week because I'm looking forward to my birthday. But this week, what am I looking forward to? I don't know. Another Saturday of lots of fascinating college football games, and hoping that we have more chaos. This week we finally had some chaos with a bunch of upsets, and I mean we had number one go down last week too, but now really the poop hit the fan this week, and I hope it continues. Oklahoma needs to lose. I hope that Oregon doesn't lose to UCLA, because I want us to beat number one Oregon, us being USC obviously. But I'll say that I'm looking forward to sitting around and not sitting around. I never get to actually sit around and watch college football anymore. It's more like running around with the girls and trying to catch a little bit here and there.
And I'll be working this weekend, so it'll be fun for you.
Yeah. It's always kind of fun to watch a little bit of sports with the girls, particular Loyette, because she totally will get into it. If I'm, you know, cheering for a team, she'll pick up on it and she'll cheer for that team too. When we went to the USC alumni club yesterday, with the girls in their little song girl outfits and stuff, Loyette was sitting there, and you know, especially at first, you know, every time anyone would make a play, she'd watch it on the screen, and as soon as the play was gotten, she'd go yay. It doesn't matter what happened, but she would just start cheering.
Loyette seats had fun clapping there too.
Oh yeah
It's amazing what a plate of french fries can do for letting you watch a little bit of football at a restaurant.
but I guess I'd say that, and just I don't know, whatever fun activities we end up doing with the girls next weekend. I'll probably have some outing on Saturday with them when you're at work. And I always enjoy doing stuff with them, whatever it is, taking them on little adventures. Loyette just loves, she's totally adopted this concept of going on adventures, even if the adventure is let's go to the store or whatever. And she'll be like, daddy, can we go on adventures? She doesn't quite get the ad. Adventures? Can we go on
adventures?
Adventures? Yeah.
Adventures.
Oh yeah. Sometimes it's adventures. That's right. And sometimes she'll be really disappointed if you don't go on an adventure. So you have to, whatever you're going to do, you try to make it into an adventure, you know, we're going to go on an adventure and walk down to the mailbox, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. This is the great thing about 2-year-olds, that, just about anything can be made exciting if you act excited about it. So I guess that's it for this week. Thanks for listening again. And, we will see you same time next week. Fight on.
Yay.
If I get into it, buddy, I've got to get into it as hard and as tough as I possibly
can. What will your agenda be, Tom? Are you going to keep talking about impeaching Obama and bombing Mecca and all that stuff?
What do you listen?
Why do you care? What do you care?
And not only that, but all of a sudden now, you are opposed to my attacks on Obama and attacks on radical Islam. And what's that got to do with this race? Nothing. I say a lot of things.
You're talking about this as a candidate for governor. I'm not.
No,
all right, wait a minute. We got the plagiarizer versus the embezzler versus Tancredo and a sanctuary city Democrat. You pick right now, Dick. Who do you like?
I'm going to support the Republican nominee.
All right. Had an evil empire just like his dear old dad. Gave him my love and the things I never had. Scott would think I was a cool guy. Return the love I have, make me want to cry. Be evil, but have my feelings too. Change my life with Oprah and Maya Angelou. But Scott rejected me. C'est la vie. Life is cruel, treats you unfairly. Even so, a God there must be. Meeting me, you complete me. Uh-huh.